видим разгул неонацистов, националистов,
под экстремистскими, антисемитов, антироссийскими и антисемитскими
вооружениями. Бесконтрольных вооруженных экстремистов развернули охоту на
нацистской и фашистской символике. Лидеры националистов
в еврейских общинах всего Крыма всерьез обеспокоены.
Украинские военнослужащие, дислоцированные в Крыму, в массовом порядке.
Массово пишут рапорты об увольнении.
В России прибывает все большее число граждан Украины, которых обыскали.
И в Брянской областях отмечается приток граждан Украины.
We've been here before, although it didn't always make international headlines. We were here in the conflicts in Georgia's breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, in Moldova's separatist Transnistria region in the early 1990s. We were here dramatically in Russia's August 2008 war with Georgia, and here we are again today, in Ukraine, in Crimea. And soon we may find ourselves in the same place yet again, in Ukraine's Russophone East. The script has been the same, as has been the result. Exploiting a local ethnic conflict, Moscow uses local proxies and then troops to seize de facto control of a Russian-speaking breakaway region in a former Soviet state. In the past, such adventures were popular at home and caused few, if any, consequences abroad. The stakes are higher this time, but do we have any reason to believe the outcome will be any different? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark. I understand in Moscow you met some of our listeners and you had something to say to them, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to say it was very great to have the honor of meeting some of my listeners in Moscow and attempt to mention that by being so hospitable and amiable and informed and engaged, they proved what I've always believed, that we get a better class of listener here at the Power Vertical.
That's good to know. And also joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
So, Crimea's parliament has voted to join the Russian Federation. The Russian State Duma is due to vote on legislation next week that would enable Russia to annex the Black Sea Peninsula. The European and the United States have imposed some sanctions and have threatened more. Mark, I've been following your blog over the past week or so, and you, like most of us, you seem to be having a debate with yourself about Russia's intentions, about whether they're really planning to annex Crimea or not. Well, it appears now we have the answer. They are. And it also appears that we have crossed a line into new and uncharted territory in the post-Cold War world. And we also have appeared to cross a line into a new chapter of Putin's rule. Where are we now, both domestically for Russia and in terms of the of international politics? Was this a game changer?
Well, I would say that actually nothing is yet fixed. I mean, yes, I have been having that internal debate like so many others. But to a large extent, I think that actually reflects the fact that there is still an internal debate going on in the Kremlin, which in many ways is between head and heart. Common sense, and up to now I've very much been assuming that the Kremlin will be sort of governed by realpolitik, and lonely Slavic sentimentalism with a little side order of brutalist imperialism. So, I mean, there is still the possibility that actually Russia will not annex the Crimea. I mean, yesterday's vote is not binding. Essentially, the Russians are the producers of this particular drama. They can just as easily let's say Kiev partly capitulates, present some new sort of form of words and all kinds of sort of guarantees. Then they could just as easily say, well, actually, we're now going to have a vote on this, and lo and behold, the Crimean Parliament will dutifully give whatever answer Moscow wants, and then they'll be able to say, okay, but we've got our eye on you, Kiev. I think it does look increasing. If we're talking about the odds are increasingly shifting towards some kind of deeply stupid and counterproductive, but nonetheless some kind of an annexation. But I don't think we're certainly at a point of no return.
What about domestically in Russia? Does this sort of usher in a new chapter in Putin's rule? And we're going to talk a little bit about the domestic implications in the first section today.
Well, I mean, I would say that it's a sort of shorter, in the short term, it only seems to be strengthening him. We've seen his approval ratings continue to be solid, and it has to be said that here in Moscow, as long as you don't put your television on and don't buy a newspaper, you wouldn't think there was any kind of a crisis or some game-changing global geopolitical sort of situation in throes of evolution. But I think the thing is that, and this is why I sort of say it's very much a decision between head and heart. If Moscow does annex, then first of all, it takes on board. I mean, there was a very good article in Vedomosti trying to actually sort of quantify. It's a $6 billion a year price tag to keep Crimea going. So in effect, it's actually giving Kiev a $6 billion a year gift, which is a pretty nice welcome. And that money will have to come from somewhere. But then also, I think we will see the West imposing extended sort of visa bans and similar. And that will begin to, I think, start eating into his credibility and popularity.
It certainly could exacerbate elite tensions.
Which is the key thing.
There was an interesting post on, and we're going to talk about more about this in the second half, but there was an interesting post on Valery Solovoy's Facebook page. He's a professor at MGMO, where he said, according to his information, according to informed sources he'd been talking to, this decision was made with just two or three people in Putin's inner circle, and none of them have assets abroad. And those in the elite that do have assets abroad are very, very, very nervous right now. But we'll get to that later in the program. Kirill, what's your take? Is this a game changer?
I agree with Mark that nothing is decided, till now. And Putin is trying, or collective Putin is trying to keep the door a bit open to other negotiations and so on. We can't overestimate all these gestures by so-called Crimean parliament and so on, because some of them, of course, some of these gestures are the result of Russian pressure and so on, but some others are just improvisation, of course, because can you imagine the level of political consciousness of the members of Crimean Parliament? I am not sure that it's quite high, yes? And I'm not trying to insult them, but they are not experienced politicians. And they are not experienced in international relationships. That's why I'm speaking. And in some legal procedures and in some legal questions. So that's why we, of course, must follow and focus on their gestures and words and so on. But I'm not sure that we must take it, too seriously. The most important things are now, and the most important game are now, is playing inside Kremlin. Of course, I'm quite cynical about the public reaction of Russian population to these events, because it's quite, frozen, yeah? But I am very interested in what's going on inside, Russian elite now. It's not just because of their assets, which are in London or somewhere. It's they're not just all these people. They're not just, the puppets of their money and their assets and so
really?
On. They, of course. So never underestimate, say Sechen and so on. They're, human beings. With their ideas, with their, perceptions, with their, whatever. And I think that if previously some of them must be, irritated by some, political gestures by Putin and his regime, but now it's not an irritation. It's, I think it's an anger. And Putin must understand this thing. The second thing which we can, discuss, focus on, is that I'm not sure that Putin actually wants to annex Crimea. I am not sure. It's such a huge problem. It's a huge problem in international relationship. I agree with Mark. It's a huge economic question and the cost of all these things and so on. But the events themselves, they have their own logic. And I'm very scary that this logic will be, in the end, much stronger than the political aims, than the rational.
That's where I think we are right now. I think this is operating according to its own logic. Well, let's stick with you. You said the main game is inside the Kremlin. And we got, you know, we're both the U.S. and the EU have announced their first wave of sanctions. They seem to be doing this step by step, escalating a little bit each time. But if we get to things like asset freezes and visa bans, I mean, the U.S. has already instituted some visa bans. This could cause some serious splits in the ruling elite, could it not? Mark or Carol, you want to go first? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I just noticed that all the sanctions, especially from the side of European Union, was suggested, you know, some words by a representative of European Union, that they try to divide so-called ordinary Russians and Russian elite. There are no any discussions about the bans for visa for, you know, ordinary people.
Right.
That's how European Union trying to press on the, you know, Russian public opinion, to divide Russian public and Russian elite, especially, you know, around the Kremlin. Secondly, the target of all the sanctions, not just, you know, all, say, Russian bureaucrats and all the ministers and so on. I think the main target, they are Russian MPs who will decide about the fate of Crimea. And that is very important because all these people, they have names. And these names are, you know, you can find in some lists of property owners in Florida and so on. So I think that it's this sort of pressure is quite sophisticated and, you know, reasonable now.
I mean, you think thinking back to when Putin began his campaign last year to get the elite to disinvest, to pull its assets back from the West, you begin to see how that there might have been some logic to that, for precisely this kind of situation. Mark, what do you think? Can these asset freezes and travel bans, if they come into force and if they really bite, and these are still two big ifs right now, will they have an effect at dividing the elite, do you think, even further?
I'd imagine that they would. I mean, I definitely want to sort of agree with almost everything Kirill said, that I'd be hesitant about the Sechin as human being comment. but beyond that, I mean, the notion that these smart sanctions are not just targeted against the elite rather than the masses, because yes, I mean, just making ordinary Russians feel as if they're being discriminated against and persecuted, that's not going to play. That actually plays to the Putin line of that we are assailed by our enemies. So it's elites, and then even better than that, it's actually elites that they can specifically point a finger at and say, you know, you are in the Federation Council, you voted to send troops in. I mean, that's one of the most sort of the obvious places. And I'd imagine that in foreign ministries and other agencies in the West, there are also people trying to sort of, you know, find out, okay, well, you know, who was involved in the presidential administration, who was involved elsewhere, to precisely sort of come up with a whole variety of different targeting lists. And I think because in some ways this speaks to one of the fundamental issues about post-1991 Russia, if we can just suddenly sort of broaden it out, it's that Russian officials, and I'm including business people in that and so forth, have too often had absolute impunity, precisely because of the fear of upsetting Russia as a whole. And therefore, I think this is a very important tack to try and adopt, to actually simply say, look, we have allowed you to become internationalized, to send your kids to foreign universities, to come and buy houses and come shopping in the West and so forth. Well, you know, now we are going to use that against you. And I think particularly if they do broaden it out to, for example, family members, that might sound pretty unfair, but nonetheless, you know, they are the the casualties in this new form of sanctions warfare, I think it will lead to a lot of very disgruntled people who had, you know, hoped to go to the south of France, and now they've got to go to Sochi.
But not only has the West kind of allowed the Russian elite to internationalize itself, but there's a lot of people in the West making a lot of money off of this. If you look at the volume, not just the volume of trade between Russia and Western Europe, but the connections that exist there, people in the West are making a lot of money, and therefore it's not surprising that in the European Union there is not a lot of appetite for asset freezes and things like that. And you have to wonder if I'm recalling the Chatham House report where it talked about Putin's strategy of capture, the attempt to capture elites in the former Soviet space to make them compliant. But at the same time, we have the capture of Western European elites. So, Mark, what do you think about that? Is this going to make this potentially difficult?
Well, inevitably it will. My concern, though, is that it's about time. And you know, I say this as also as someone who, you know, much of his activities depends on being able to get a visa to come to Russia or that kind of thing. But my concern is that exactly too often that consideration, how will it affect our national economy? How will it affect powerful and rich people here? Has been used as a reason to not act. You know, there is no way that smart sanctions, even smart sanctions, cannot have some kind of a cost to the West as well. I think it's just a question of, well, are you willing to pay that cost?
When you have to wonder if the West is indeed ready to pay that cost, if they see this crisis as the watershed that I see it as. And I'm not sure about the U.S. response looks a little bit more robust than we've seen in the past. Europe seems to be on board, although not depending on which day you look at where Europe's at on that day. But I'm wondering if the gravity of this has sunk in the West to the extent that, yes, we're going to have to bear some cost in this as well. Kirill, I think there's something you wanted to say here.
Yes,
as well.
Yes. Just one thing. It's about the economic or even, you know, political cost of the sanctions for the West itself. One of the most disappointing moments during this crisis and so on was that the very day when, you know, not the war had been declared, but, you know, the intention had been declared by Russia, that was a huge Maslenitsa festival on the Trafalgar Square in London, which is hugely supported by London Mayor Boris Johnson. Of course, it's a very important thing. It's, you know, a year of Britain in Russia and so on. But anyway, this is an event which is supported by Russian state. And that was a very good opportunity to cancel everything this particular day. And that will be a very, you know, serious symbolic gesture. Of course, London and will, you know, London as an economy will lose some money, you know, canceling this event. But I think the increasing of symbolic political capital and, you know, having in mind the intentions of Boris Johnson himself to be, you know, a huge figure in the Conservative Party and so on, that would be, you know, very wise and logical to do this. But he didn't cancel the event. And I think that this is just, you know, a small example of how this new style sanctions war can be, you know, played.
Yeah. Now, no, and one has to recall that that famous document that was photographed by a BBC reporter, where basically the argument was, you know, sanctions are fine, but let's make sure they don't touch the city of London.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about that we're obviously talking about asset freezes. And this is the point. If these sanctions are going to work, they're going to have to touch the city of London. I wanted to also, something else I wanted to touch on was Mark, you briefly touched on this, saying in Moscow you would never know some major crisis is going on and people aren't paying attention, but the issue of dissent inside of Russia among the population. Looking back a week ago, when we talked about, you know, Russia's battle at home and abroad to fight this. One of the things we talked about was the placing of Navalny under house arrest. It seems to me this was no accident that this happened the day before all of this business started, the day before the Federation Council authorized the sending troops to Ukraine. Do you think they were trying just to neutralize him? Because he's been very outspoken on this. He's definitely got the ability to rile up certain segments of the population. Do you see these two events as connected?
Honestly, I'm not sure. He provided them with a perfect opportunity. It was fairly clear anyway that after Sochi, there was going to be some kind of a sort of tightening of the screws. And therefore, even if there hadn't been any sort of plans to do anything with the Crimea, then I suspect that they would have taken this perfect opportunity to muzzle him.
He can't use the internet either, so he can't even agitate online.
That's how you muzzle him. I mean, anyway, that's
the only way to muzzle him.
Way of muzzling him or whatever. But I mean, I think at the same time, what we have to realize is, you know, and again, going back to the sort of some earlier points, this to me feels very much like a policy which is currently all being handled on an ad hoc basis, and it's what they happen to think of today, and who happens to be to have the presidential ear today. And therefore, in that respect, I think we should be cautious. You know, human beings are great pattern finders. You know, we will tend to look at things and assume that they somehow form some kind of connection. I think we have to accept that, particularly at the moment, there is actually just simply a lot of chaos and a lot of uncertainty, even to the point of, you know, I cannot imagine that if he'd had an opportunity to do so, Foreign Minister Lavrov, who is a wily operator, would have allowed himself to be in the position of making such a fool of himself by sort of claiming that there are no Russian troops, and he you know, as far as he's concerned, they're just these sort of self-dressed volunteers who happen to have gone to the bring and buy assault rifle and grenade launcher.
And if you look at the CCTV of the when they took Parliament, this was if they were just citizen volunteers, they are highly trained, highly professional citizen volunteers.
Obviously, they're exactly rock hard. They are in the Crimea quite clearly. But I mean, I think that you might say that's not the sort of situation he would have wanted to put himself in, because a diplomat, a foreign minister, a diplomat, you know, relies on his plausibility and his credibility. So, I mean, I think generally speaking, I think everyone is scrambling to make the best of situations at the moment, rather than this being part of some sort of careful chess game.
I mean, we're going to talk about this more in the second half, but is Putin out here on his own here? I mean, it's kind of the elitist following because they have no other alternative. Is that what it looks like? This is just a decision made by a small cabal?
I think it's a small cabal. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's
a microcosm of the deep state. It's not even the whole deep state.
Exactly. It's the mini collective Putin. And I think, in a way,
mini collective Putin.
That's the whole problem. I can't help. I mean, just to go historically, I mean, back when I was doing my doctorate on the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, one of the things I was trying to look at was exactly at that point, well, how was the decision process made? You know, how did they reach that decision? And the thing that it became very obvious was precisely it was a small ad hoc subgroup of the Politburo, of whom the two people who actually knew what they were talking about when it came to Afghanistan, Andropov and Gromyko, were both being deceived by people within their own structures, and anyway had reasons to basically not go against the consensus. And most of the rest, they probably scarcely knew where Afghanistan was. I think this is a problem. We actually have small circles of people who often have very, very little practical experience of the area, what's going to be involved, the foreign policy implications. But the point is, because they cohere around the guy at the top, they're the ones that make the final decision.
Right. Kirill, what about this on the domestic dissent? I mean, the other thing that caught my attention, of course, was Andrei Zubov's article in Vedomosti. It didn't just catch my attention. It caught everybody's attention that follows Russia. But Andrei Zubov, a professor at MGMO, wrote an article in Vedomosti. We interviewed him here at RFERL about his motivations for doing so. But he wrote an article in Vedomosti comparing Putin to Hitler, basically, the policy in Crimea to Hitler's policy in the Sudetenland. It's an old truism that if you bring Hitler into an argument, you lose. But I don't know. I think, I mean, Zubov's piece kind of did resonate in a bit. And you have to wonder if MGMO professors are willing to express this publicly, this kind of sentiment publicly. You have to wonder how widespread the dissent truly is. No?
In this particular case, I can't agree with you, because Andrei Zubov, he is a well-known Moscow professor with a quite liberal, maybe even, you know, very liberal views.
But the fact that he was willing to go public in this atmosphere, to publish this article in Vietnamese, almost to invite reprisal against him, is telling, no?
I'm not sure that in this particular case, of course, because Andrei Zubov is well known. He's as an author, he of course very allowed to publish whatever and whenever he wants and so on.
But he compared Putin to Hitler.
You know,
publicly.
It's not, it's not an exclusion, you know, so quite often now. But I'd like to focus on two interesting things, which the first one we already, you know, just discussed about Navalny. I think Russian authorities now are very polite to Navalny, because being mute now in the case of Navalny is a very good situation, because he is a very strange position. On the one hand, he must oppose all this, you know, Russian politics and aggression and so on. At the same time, if he will or if he would oppose all this stuff, definitely he will lose some of his supporters.
Some of his nationalist supporters.
Yes, of course. And he's a quite tricky situation. And to be mute in this particular, you know, days is not the best, not the worst situation.
Mm-hmm. So they may have done him a favor.
Yeah, yeah. Secondly, we already told about, discussed about the what's the circle of decision makers around Putin and so on. I'd like to draw your attention to one very interesting fact. How Putin is, poorly advised. Poor him. By the way, that was a mini scandal around Sergei Glazyev's statement about that Russian finance will withdraw from US dollar and so on. And he, at the very same time, he was absolutely abrupted and stopped by some people from the cabinet. And it was told that this is the opinion of Sergei Glazyev, not the political and economical advisor of Vladimir Putin, but he is his opinion as an academic.
Uh-huh.
It's quite funny, because you can imagine two different opinions of academic and, you know, another one as a husband, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, you know, Sergei Glazyev, you know, is not, how to say it, very clever advisor. All of us know about, you know, his views on the economy and the politics and so on. And the very idea he is now, and what is, I think in Vedomosti was a very interesting article about the inner and outer circle of Putin advisors about Ukraine and so on. I know some of them, of these people, Glazyev and Konstantin Zatulin, by the way, mm-hmm. notorious, and so on. So if such people like Glazyev and Zatulin are advising for in such, you know, important, crucial situation, I'm not sure that Russian gestures and politics could be reasonable. So that is a great, not great, but quite big disaster on the level of, cadre.
Right.
Yes. And that is one of the interesting results of Putin's rule,
right.
Because social lifts are closed, and so you can't, clever and educated people can't find, you know, a job in the presidential administration and so on. That absolutely different to the situation what was during Surkov's times.
Right. So, and we're going to zero in on this aspect of things in the second half. And before we get to that, I just wanted to touch on a couple of points very briefly. Mark, you alluded to how the Russian elite has internationalized. In that environment now, can Russia be isolated? And are we moving into, I think it's way overused, but the term a new Cold War keeps coming up as this crisis goes on, being since it is the biggest East-West crisis since the end of the Cold War. But what about that? Is it possible to even isolate Russia right now?
I don't think it's actually advisable to do so. I mean, first of all, no one is turning around and saying we will not buy Russian oil and gas, for example.
I don't think anybody has the option to do that.
Exactly. So, I think immediately becomes rather, isolated, except for its main export.
Right.
I think we have to be realistic about what we're talking about. Now, if isolated means basically being nasty to them and making them feel alone, well, that's possible. But the point is that, I think this, going back to the whole issue of the smart sanctions, the key thing is not to try and make Russia feel that it is under unfair aggression, in effect. If you do so, you play to the tropes that Putin is playing. It is instead much more a sense of, well, if you do X, then there are consequences Y. But on the other hand, if you don't do X, then Y will not happen, and nice thing Z could possibly happen. Mm. Now, I know it makes it sound as if it's sort of, raising a five-year-old or house training a dog, which sound terribly demeaning kind of parallels. And I really don't mean it, but you might say, I think there is a sense that, in fact, it is in the world community's interests to have a Russia which is actually a happy, stable member of the existing regime. And the tragedy is that the last 20-plus years have not seen that happen, have not seen Russia find its place. And therefore, it's prey to someone like Putin, who basically plays the spoiler. Now, so I think there has to be two sides of that. There has to be the element in which you punish people who are involved for doing bad things, but at the same time that you do not isolate, that you actually more or less say, look, these are all the wonderful opportunities for being a part of a respected and effectively cooperating part of the world community. And I think, the challenge is going to be to balance the two. And this is why, I really despair about the sense of a sort of new Cold War. Well, apart from the fact that the Cold War, anyway, had this ideological dimension or whatever. But it implies, basically, that one side or the other is going to build a wall. And I think as soon as we build a wall, what we're more or less saying is, Mr. Putin, do feel free to take Eurasia. We will try and lock you out of the rest of the world, but Eurasia, that can be your playground.
Well, one has to wonder if this continues on the current trajectory. And we keep bantering about this new Cold War phrase. But what form would this, do you see this taking if it turns into some form of semi-permanent institutionalized East-West conflict? What form do you see that taking? Of course, we're not going to go back to the Cold War of 1945 to 1991, but what do you see?
Well, exactly. I think it's going to be something entirely new because we have never had a world that is so interconnected. This is why also when one looks at some of the wilder geopolitical assertions about the role of China in the world, it omits the minor detail that China is the workshop of the world and that both the rest of the world and China depend on that. Well, likewise, We've never seen this kind of, on the one hand, geopolitical tensions played out against a backdrop of the same degree of globalizing integration. And therefore, what we're going to see is going to be something new. But I think, again, it's going to be something in which there has to be a much, much clearer direct correlation of cause and effect. Cold War was basically, we think you are evil, you other side, whoever you may be, whatever flag you happen to have. We think you are evil, and therefore we will compete against you. Pretty much regardless of what's going on. There are some, a handful of issues on which we might cooperate, but basically thinking we think you are fundamentally wrong and bad. Now, that's not going to work. Now, in this case, it might well be, well, fine, you take Crimea, we're going to do X and Y, or, by the way, the rest of Ukraine, we're going to, provide with some new security guarantees, and there's going to be tripwires of NATO forces based in eastern Ukraine, just in case you invade, or whatever. But the point is they will be connected, or they have to be, connected directly to the issue, rather than being just much more fundamentally, Russia, we think you're a rogue state, a pariah state, or all these other sort of useless terms that are sometimes bandied around.
Kirill, last word to you before we move on to the second section.
I agree. Of course, it's we are observing now an absolutely new type of such conflict in postmodern. Sorry for this terminology. In postmodern,
you love that
world.
Terminology.
Yes, but the only thing is that West is postmodern, but Russia is not postmodern. It's modern, you know, in academic terms. It's a the very rhetoric of Russian government is absolutely so. I'm listening to all their words. I remember 19th century. It's all rhetoric from nationalist period of. It's not such bad, of course, because you know in some countries, you know, Chandra Petofi or Adam Mickiewicz and so on, they're heroes, and they were. Really heroes, but they were heroes in their particular time. So the main problem of returning to today's situation, the main problem of this new type of conflict, it's not, of course, new Cold War and so on, crack of doom not coming soon. But anyway, the main problem is that the both sides of this conflict, they are not on the same level. Of their development. I'm not speaking about economy and so on. I'm speaking about the type of political and social consciousness and mind. It's a postmodern world against modern world. Mm-hmm. It's a post-nationalist world against nationalist world. Nationalist in the terms of 19th century. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. But it's interesting that at the same time, the so-called Ukrainian Revolution, if we can, you know, describe it in this way, it was also absolutely surrounded by the rhetoric of modern age, of 19th century. It was like a national revolution with irredentist slogans and so on. So that is very interesting. So as a trained historian, I wonder how it will go on because such an interesting thing. It's like, you know, it's like Iwasowski against Damien Hirst.
Well, if one wants to be an optimist, we can just say that these are the inevitable turbulence of a new world being born. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at what Russia's moves in Ukraine tell us about how the Kremlin makes decisions. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia Security Services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
What is our biggest concern? The fact that we are witnessing an orgy of neo-Nazis, nationalists, and anti-Semites in some parts of Ukraine, Kiev included.
Fascists running around Kiev, refugees streaming into Russia from eastern Ukraine, rampant anti-Semitic attacks, assaults on Orthodox churches, mass defections from the Ukrainian military. These are just some of the exaggerated or demonstrably false stories that Russian media have been disseminating and Russian officials have been dutifully repeating as tensions continue to boil over in Ukraine. According to the New York Times, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that Putin was living in another reality, although the German government later denied this. But one has to wonder, especially after watching Putin's press conference this week, where we just heard a clip from at the start here, if he isn't beginning to believe his own propaganda. Mark, is he, and what does that point to?
Well, I mean, first of all, the honest answer is I don't.
Of course you don't know. What do you think? But, you mean you didn't meet with Putin right before this podcast and ask him if he believes his own propaganda or not?
I thought I gave you that assignment, damn it. Would actually, you know, says something in and itself that he won't return my calls. Now, I mean, I think, you know, although sort of this whole notion of sort of Yatsenyuk as fifth horseman of the apocalypse, is increasingly surreal, let me give you sort of two possible answers and then tell you which one I think is right. I mean, one is that this is just simply in the tradition of Russian propaganda, just perhaps sort of, you know, dialed up to 11. But they have a tendency to, I think it's fair to say, slightly overstate the case. you know, when they want to make the point. But I think the second view and the one that I am beginning to incline goes back to what I was saying at the beginning about this being a sort of a battle between head and heart, is that there are the lies that we tell because we want to rationalize and justify, and then there are the lies that we tell often enough that we actually come to believe. And although I imagine that Putin is getting accurate intelligence reports.
Are you sure about that?
Well, fairly. I mean, yeah, obviously, there's going to be differences. I mean, there's a rumor, for example, that he actually angrily sacked Ukraine desks, or, you know, staff from the Ukraine desks at both the Foreign Intelligence Service and the FSB when he came back from Sochi. So angry was he that they hadn't predicted Yanukovych's fall. I think he's aware of the need for good intelligence. But on the other hand, there is a question of, okay, but how far does it get sort of tweaked and modified? And this is, I think, the issue. And in a way, it plays to so many other things, like the departure of people like Surkov from his inner
who
circle.
Who was in Ukraine last month, incidentally.
I'm
wondering where his hand is. Kirill's shaking his head. I don't know what's up here.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're talking about the danger of connecting dots and creating conspiracies. Or maybe he was the sniper.
But his portfolio in the Kremlin is to deal with relations with Ukraine. He was in Ukraine, in Crimea, by the way. Last month, so I don't know.
Yeah,
I
suspect.
Just saying.
Just saying. One of my favorite phrases. But I mean, I suspect though precisely he was given that portfolio when it wasn't thought that actually relations with Ukraine was going to be a pivotal issue. But I think going back to it, I think there is this issue of that sort of Putin does seem to be narrowing his circle, and there does seem to be the implication that he's less and less tolerant of bad news and tough truths, and the result of that is in some ways that the sort of the deep state, the bit that really matters, gets deeper and deeper, and less of the light from the surface
and
ever
more and more delusional,
it.
And more and more delusional.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes decisions. Even it means that it might say it makes what seem to be rational decisions, but are actually irrational ones because they're based on inaccurate information or a bizarre misreading of the reality. And again, you know, we can go back to 1979. It was deeply stupid of the Soviets to go into Afghanistan in 1979. However, it made sense if what you were basing it on were certain sets of assumptions and certain kind of reports that were being presented to you.
Faulty, delusional assumptions.
Yeah, exactly. So that is exactly my concern, is that we still have a rational actor, but basing it, you know, it's garbage in and garbage out, basing it on irrational information.
Does this point to the deterioration of the deep state?
It points to the deterioration of the Putin system. I mean, I think, again, it's the extent to which, you know, we are increasingly seeing not just the politics of the court dominate, but the court becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, theoretically speaking, the Tsar's court can be a place in which you can bring the best and the brightest together. It can also be where you just simply bring your hacks and your personal friends.
Right.
And I suspect we're moving towards the latter.
Kirill, you've been paying attention to this in the Russian media a lot. Who do you see in the inner circle here, the tiny, tiny, tiny little court that's making these decisions? You mentioned Glazyev. Who else do you see?
Well, it's not an inner circle. In one article I read, so just rumors, of course, that was Sechin, who he was, you know, by Putin when the decision had been made and so on. But I think there are two different, quite different sides of the situation. First is, how to say it, it's a logic of late dictator regimes. Just a personal note. When I was young, I read a lot of Latin American novels about dictators and so on. Roa Bastos, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and whoever. And that was their favorite subject. And now I'm recognizing just recognizing the situation with, you know, this old, quite old dictator who is, you know, just tired to be a dictator. At the same time, he don't want to leave. The second question is how we can rationalize the quite unrational behavior, especially in international relations. You must, you know, just to try to go on business as usual, as, if we are speaking about West. How can West declare that we are dealing with some, you know, like Angela Merkel told, with the man who is living in this absolutely other world, yes? So just to pretend that everything is perfect and he is still a reasonable person.
Well, I see a change this time, actually. I see a change in that this time the West is kind of calling Russia out on all of these. The State Department, I was actually surprised by this, put out that that bit on its website, the lies of Putin. I'm trying to remember if they use the word lies or misinformation or what kind of politer language they use, but and debunked each of them. In the past, when Russia was saying crazy stuff like this, and remember in the Georgia War, they were screaming about genocide in South Ossetia, for God's sakes. It was like so over the top, but everybody just kind of ignored it. Okay, this is what Russia does. They kind of overstate their case and go over the top. This time, The U.S. State Department has pointed out each and every one of these and debunked it with evidence. So it's kind of becoming media's writing about this, you know, the big lie, the wag the dog, all of the myths that are being put out there. Nobody believes it outside of Russia this time. Mark, does that matter?
Well, it matters for Russia. But in a way, Kirill is right that in terms of sort of geopolitics, it matters in the sense of precisely that I think the West is coming to that realization that, and I'm not going to use the word appeasement, but it can't make a deal at the moment in terms that will satisfy Putin and satisfy Putin's neighbors and what the West regards as the universal values of the international system. And that's why I think this is why it's very reluctantly kicking and screaming. The West is coming to that view of, well, okay, how can we, and they're not using terms like regime change, but how can we bring behavioral change to Russia in a way that they've never before?
Yeah, no, then again, going back to the point I made at the outset, I think we have, whether we know it or not, have crossed a line into a different period. Before we wrap up, I just want to get both of your thoughts on one thing. I mean, the meme was going around. I heard it. Merkel's comment kind of started it, but then others, including Belkovsky, including Stanislav Belkovsky, in some interviews, suggested that Putin had lost his mind. Andrei Zubov, in his article in Vanity and in his interview with us here at RFE, was speaking along the same lines. Mark, you on your blog, you were having a debate with yourself about was whether Putin was rational right now and whether the Kremlin decision-making. What do you make of this debate? What does this point to? I mean, we're having a serious discussions in the media of whether the president of the largest country in the world had taken leave of his senses. Now, again, maybe that's hyperbole on our side to the extent of all the hyperbole we've heard from the Russian side. But what does that point to?
I mean, I think it's important when you start to have Russians saying that. I mean, the West has always been saying similar things. I think it's important when Russians say that. And to be honest, I would just want to endorse, I think, you know, Kirill was spot on with this sort of notion of the increasingly lonely dictator who's finding dictatorship not much fun, but is afraid of letting go.
Kirill? Last word to you, briefly.
Last word to me, briefly. So I think that that's the main question now. So it's not about the national interests of Russia and so on. It's strange, but we are speaking about the psychological condition of one man.
That, unfortunately, is about all we have time for today. I would like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant and overworked producer Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.